This is one of two very long lessons in this quarter. And in terms of material, we are covering a tremendous amount of material. In fact, in terms of page count in Bob's book, we cover with this 41 pages out of 133 here by two lessons. One-fourth of the material, or one-third of the material, and one-sixth of the time. But I think it's important to go ahead and try to cover this in this class. I'm going to try to do that. We are in a strong situation as far as the approach to the class. There is so much material to be done, and it is primarily a study of the law at this point. And after this, we'll begin to see more narrative and more history in some of the rest of the study. But bear with this for a little while. Hopefully, it'll get a little bit easier as we get into the next set of lessons. What we're studying here is the theme in the lesson book, Be Ye Holy, For I Am Holy, For I, the Lord, Am Holy. And that is a passage repeated over and over throughout the book of Leviticus and numerous other places. But it sets the tone and sets the heart for the study of the law as to why these laws are given and why they should be obeyed. So let's begin with our introduction. It's rather lengthy, but it sets us up, I think, properly for the rest of this lesson. At this point, it's pointed out that as far as the book of Leviticus is concerned, if you're doing teaching and you want to recite narrative, go over narrative, storytelling material, there's not too much to work on in the book of Leviticus. There's only three events or items of a historical nature, which we studied in the last class. And that was the consecration of the priest, the death of Nadab and Abihu, and we studied at the end of the class the stoning of the one who had blasphemed the name of the Lord. The remainder of the book of Leviticus details the law, and we're talking here the Mosaic law, as to how Israelites were to live as God's people. From a close examination of the details of this book, we find God repeatedly telling the Israelites, Be ye holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy. I am the Lord your God who makes you holy. There is no other source or means for that. You can't do it yourself. Question arises, how shall they be holy? And the answer to that is through his law and his law only and their obedience to it. And all these details of the law, we find God saying this, that they are to be his special people out of all other peoples in the world. And they are to do this by becoming like him in his nature and character. In this way, they would be different to all other peoples because he, Jehovah, was different from all else, spiritually speaking. There was none else like him. What does the word holy mean? A study of the Bible and any good word dictionary will show that it really supports several ideas, but one, it means to be different from other things, especially common things. Consecrated and set apart for special function and purpose and use. Devoted, that is, it is committed and it is as far as its sense or purpose and function. Recall Isaiah chapter 6 and the great throne scene where Isaiah sees the Lord in a vision sitting on his throne and the seraphims flying around. And I asked the question, what are the seraphims saying? What they were saying in that question. Holy, holy, holy. And it's interesting to think about this. And of all the things they wanted to impress Isaiah with, it was the holiness of God, that he is holy. And that humbled, seeing that and hearing that, humbled Isaiah. And he said he was a man of unclean lips dwelling amongst a people of unclean lips. Well, they were to be God's special people through his law, and they were shown, or they are shown in the course of this, what holy means. They are called to be holy. In other words, there's a call given. This is what we want you to do, what you want you to be. And then they're shown how they are to be holy. and that is, of course, through the law. The Old Testament story would in time show many would fail to see God as the law revealed Him to be, and many would simply see it as a set of rules to conform to and never see its underlying message. And if I could say one thing here, I think this is a problem we still have today, even amongst Christians. There is a disposition sometimes to look at the Bible as just a set of rules, and if I do this, this, and this, I'm okay. When in fact, yes, you should do those things, but you're looking also at what it is telling you about God and His nature, His character. And that is, of course, being conveyed. So many would simply see it as a set of rules and never see this underlying message. And we'll see that as we go through the Old Testament study. I want to say that as far as time in this class, we do have to limit ourselves on a detailed study of the law. We're going to cover a lot of material on the law just tonight. So by necessity, it's an overview. I would suggest you seek out further classes for a more complete text and subject study, which, by the way, is the one kind I prefer to both sit in as well as teach. I am not comfortable doing this much material in this short of time when I know that there's much more that needs to be known and understood, and we don't have time to probe those things. But much of what is covered here, I would also remind you that when you get into the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is making his farewell speeches to Israel. He will review many of the things you see here. And as I was looking at Deuteronomy some today, I saw over and over some of the things we're going to study here repeated by Moses in those farewell speeches. Finally, let's look at where are we at in Israel's history up to this point in time. Reminder that the tabernacle has been set up. We studied that in the last class. It was done on the first day, the first month, the second year after having left Egypt. The Passover feast has been observed. It's on the 14th day of the first month in the second year. However, they are still count at Mount Sinai. Because, as you remember from the last class, there were those who had not been able to partake of the Passover feast, and they knew that they were commanded to do so, but they could not because they were unclean by virtue of contact, having come in contact with a dead body. And those who had come in contact with a dead body were forbidden to partake of anything holy as well as to assemble with those around the tabernacle. So that was their situation. I've been told to do this, but I've also been told to do something else. It created a dilemma. The people asked the question, what shall we do? Moses brings this matter to God, and God provides an answer, and that is for made provision for a second occasion to observe the Passover. But he went further to include those who had not been able to partake because they had been on a journey. And as we mentioned, people traveled. People could get detained for any number of reasons on a journey and not make it back. And so that could very well have been their situation. In this class, we're going to talk now largely about things that are clean and unclean. We want to ask ourselves the question, what is this all about, things clean and unclean? But the Lord had told them that they were not to render themselves detestable. They should not make themselves unclean. And the question then is, what should they do? They are to consecrate themselves. And the reason, what we want to ask is why. He gives them four reasons. One, I am the Lord, your God, because I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of Egypt to be your God. Because I am holy. Not only am I your God, but I am holy. So that's the third thing he's bringing home. And then he says, because God's presence was amongst them, he said, lest you die in uncleanness by defiling the tabernacle where God's presence was among them. So these are the four reasons we identify in the book of Leviticus as to why they were to be separate. And God gave them abundant motivation and rationale for that. I summarize this and put what I call a bottom line, and that is they were to be clean and undefiled because of who He, that is God, was, what He had done for them, because He was among them. and ask the question or make statement. Think on this. Same bottom line for God's people today. How should we then live? I think the answer is yes. We should be separate and apart from the world because of who God is, what He has done for us, and that He also is among us. I want to let you think about this. God taught them that, and as we study it, we see that borne out and reminded of it in the New Testament. Now, relative to things clean and unclean, we want to remember that sin is the greatest defilement. But under the law, God had provided a sacrificial system to deal with those sins. On the other hand, in most cases, laws pertaining to cleanness were not dealing with sinful matters. This is something we sometimes don't recognize. They were generally not sinful unless the thing was also forbidden. Pork, as mentioned in Bob's book, is one where coming in contact with pork was to render one unclean, but one was also told not to eat that. So eating it in that case would have been a sin, as well as made one unclean. But in most cases, matters of uncleanness were not in and of themselves matters of sin. For example, one could be unclean if one was a woman who gave birth to a child. That was not a sin in any sense, but it was a ceremonial kind of uncleanness. And we want to try to get this point across. Also, husband and wife relations could be a matter of uncleanness under what we're going to study. But that was not a sin either. Contact with a dead person was not a sin, but it did make one unclean. Leprosy, through no fault of one's own, one is sick. That's not a sin. One has done nothing to bring that on themselves. So it was a sin, however, to fail. And this is the point. It was a sin to fail to neglect the law's prescribed time wherein one should set aside till one was clean, and the means to reestablish cleanness before God. Now, one other thing that I want to mention is that sometimes we can look at all of these laws and we begin to think about why God gave them, and we say, oh, I see some things here. I perceive some benefits. And we may perceive benefits to the practice of the laws pertaining to cleanness. For example, benefits such as safer and healthier diets and all that comes from that. Sanitation. Practice of that individually and throughout the camp would help them as far as health was concerned. The fact that some things required quarantines and isolation to prevent outbreak of contagion, we can see those were beneficial. But there's more than that, and that is these were secondary. It was enough that God just said it, and we don't have to have a reason. We don't have to understand it. We are to do it because He said it. And when we learn that, then we are in a better position to understand some of the things in the New Testament. We do them because God said them. We may not always know why. Sometimes people say, well, I would do that if I just knew why. Well, if God said it, you don't have to know why. That'd be helpful, but it's not necessary. It was enough that God said it so they could be clean and His camp undefiled, and thereby holy before Him and the world. They were to be set apart, consecrated. Finally, if one was unclean for any of the reasons we're fixing to study here shortly, there was some consequences of that. During the time of their uncleanness, they cannot touch any holy thing. They could not be part of any public assembly or convocation of the people. And this is what really was involved in the people who had touched a dead body and could not partake of the Passover. And this last one, they cannot partake of a religious feast. Well, I'll just break and say, does anybody have any comments here at this point? Questions? Covering a lot of material, trying to lay down some basic, understandings here before we proceed with some of this. There is the matter then of clean versus unclean animals and what could one eat versus not eat. God defines some things to be clean, that is okay to eat. He defines some of those here as any beast, for instance. This is an animal having both split hoof and chewing the cud. And chewing the cud refers to those ruminant animals who regurgitate their food and go through an additional digestive process before swallowing it again. Cows chew the cud. for instance. But the animal had to have both split hoof and chewing the cud. Any water creature with both fins and scales. Any winged insect with joint legs and that hopped. Can you eat grasshoppers? It would seem so. They are permitted. Most birds, but not all birds, and we're going to talk about some of those they couldn't eat of later. Now, what about things that were unclean, that is not okay to eat? First, any animal not meeting both qualifications. For instance, a camel chewed the cud but did not have a divided hoof. And hogs had a divided hoof but didn't chew the cud. So those were considered unclean because they didn't meet both qualifications. Birds of prey and such birds as capture game to eat, eagles, falcons, hawks, owls. I was looking at that some more. That also included, apparently, birds that you wouldn't normally think of there, but would include birds, seabirds, gulls, seagulls, ospreys, and some of those that would always fly around and capture fish. They would be considered birds of prey under the definition here. Then there were birds that feeded on carrion, and by that, dead things, no longer living. There are those creatures that are in God's cleanup shop, if you will. Vultures being one that comes to my mind around here, buzzards. But anyway, flying insects that walked but did not hop. And I think that would include something we call a praying mantis. They walk, they do not hop, and I'm not sure I think they fly some. You may think of others. Flying insects that swarm, that would include bees, for instance. Those were swarming insects that flew, but they could not eat those. Animals that hunted prey, such as dogs, cats, and this one surprised me, bears, fall in this category. Animals moving low to the ground, such as lizards, Komodo dragons, weasels, rats, and so forth. Then there were those that sort of kind of moved on the ground, such as snakes and moles and worms. Well, if one was defiled by an unclean creature, then here are the things that are said. One who eats something unclean is detestable immediately. One who touches an unclean thing is also unclean until the evening. One who picks up a carcass is unclean until evening, but also must wash his clothes. There were rules for vessels, and whether they were of a particular kind, whether they were pottery or wood or maybe even a gourd. There were different things for different kinds of vessels, garments, skins of animals. If one had skins, they could be made unclean. Sacks defiled by contact with a dead body would be unclean. Then there was the matter of nature being what it is. Sometimes a creature will fall into a stream or a creek or a spring or a pool of water, a bird fall out of the sky, whatever. But springs or wells where dead creatures fell in, they were considered not unclean since water moved. And I take from that that wells perhaps refer to flowing wells, maybe artesian wells or some other kind. We think of dug wells where water is sitting, which we know in some places this might not quite fit. So I think the fact that it was a place where water moved, that flowing cleansed itself. But on the other hand, if you didn't like that dead animal in your spring and you wanted to get it out, well, guess what? One removing the dead creature would be unclean until he cleansed himself in the manner God had prescribed. Then there was grain. And, of course, Israel, that was one of the primary crops they had, was grain. And grain and harvesting it was threshed and stored. And here's the point made here. Dry grain in contact with a dead creature was not unclean. I take it by that if you went out and opened up a sack of grain and found a mouse in there, the grain was not unclean, but if you handled it, getting it out, you would be unclean until you went through the cleansing. But on the other hand, if grain was wet, and that might even include green grain as well as grain that had been made wet, if it came in contact with a dead creature, it was unclean and unusable. Here's one. If someone was defiled unawares by contact with something unclean, it was a sin simply because you being unaware of it, you couldn't cleanse it, cleanse yourself. You remained uncleansed. Therefore, until you were cleansed, you were guilty of a sin. When made aware, confession was required and the prescribed sin offering was to be made. Sometimes we have the question, is someone guilty of sin if they don't know it? This is a case in point where demonstrated that they are. Uncleanness after childbirth. Woman after childbirth was unclean until her days of purification were completed. Whether it was a boy or a girl determined the number of days of her purification. I just know someone's going to say, what if it's twins and one's a boy? I would assume that the girl, which required the longest days of purification, would determine the days of her purification. But while she was unclean, she could not touch any holy thing. She could not eat the peace offering or Passover or come into the sanctuary. Still, there's no sin because she's unclean by virtue of this childbirth. At the end of her days of purification, a prescribed offering is mentioned in the Bible, but it is according to one's financial means. And whatever your financial means were, what the scriptures provided for that, you were to make that offering. Recall Mary and Joseph at Jesus' birth were required to give only a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Luke chapter 2 and verse 24. It is from this passage alone that students of the Bible conclude that Mary and Joseph were of poor financial means. Then there is a matter of uncleanness from skin diseases called leprosy. And the Bible uses this term quite a bit, and it appears that it's used to cover a variety, several varieties of skin ailments, not just our term that we use today known as Hansen's disease. We call that leprosy, and usually that's the only thing that comes in our mind when we hear of leprosy. It was what we would call Hansen's disease, one of the most dreaded, of course, among the ancients. It was virtually impossible for it to be healed. Of course, the miracle associated with Naaman and Christ healing the lepers shows that God could heal it. One form of leprosy appeared to be what we would call elephantiasis, a truly gruesome disease. Sometimes Bible context can help us understand the kind of leprosy under consideration. Sometimes it just is not enough. Well, if one was thought to have leprosy, or he himself thought he had it, or someone looked at him and said, I see something there, I think you need to be concerned. Well, there had to be a way. One just didn't quarantine himself. Well, there were ways to confirm detection of leprosy among the people. And one of those ways was for one who had a skin blemish of concern to go to the priest to have it examined and a diagnosis made based on rules established in the law. And what I'm saying is that the law itself provides a way to identify whether it is one of these leprous, so-called skin ailments called a leprous condition. And sometimes in that examination, one could be clearly ruled out. Sometimes one could be clearly ruled in. And sometimes it was a situation, well, I just don't know. We got to wait a little longer. And so if there was a confirmation that leprosy was certain and therefore dangerous, it meant the leper then had to immediately begin to follow certain rules of the law. If not confirmed by the priest on first examination and therefore remained uncertain, then the suspected possible leper remained confined for a week and reexamined 1 week at a time. In words, this just doesn't go away if next week it's still there and the next week it's still there. So you have to keep doing that until it can be clearly determined it is or it isn't. You've got to resolve it with certainty. The law identified some seven kinds of skin ailments that were to be examined for leprosy. If one was found to have leprosy, the law provided that there was certain conduct required of this leper during his days of infection. Clothes were to be torn or rent, hair of his head uncovered and left unkempt. There was no washing and combing of the hair or anything like that. He was to cover his mustache. Now, a woman could have leprosy, so I don't know how this quite fits. So I concluded that perhaps it refers to the mouth. But in any case, they were to cover their mustache or mouth, and everywhere in the presence of others, they were to cry, unclean, unclean, so others would know to not come near them and be in contact with them, and they become unclean. They were required, this seems hard, but this is the case. Remember, God said it. They were to live alone outside the camp. They had to have a dwelling outside the camp. And, of course, as we've mentioned, they could not touch any holy thing. Well, then there's the matter of cleansing of the leper in the day that they are healed or become well. When this is thought to have occurred, word was to be brought to the priest. You may remember when Christ healed some lepers, he said, go show yourself to the priest. Well, word was to be brought to the priest, who must go outside camp to inspect the matter of the skin condition of the leper. If found to be healed, then the healed person had to carefully follow certain particular rules for their cleansing. And I haven't detailed those here, but the scriptures provide those. So that the next day after, they would be ready to re-enter fellowship with Jehovah. And I think this is a signal thing, as this was determined to be behind them. While fellowship had been severed, they had no contact with the rest of God's people, now they will be permitted, and they are to be fully accepted back once the priest has confirmed that this is indeed healed. These rules required making offerings or sacrifices in a prescribed manner. Financial means determined those offerings as to what should be done. Afterward, the healed person was to be counted as clean and could be in full fellowship with the people of God. And it's worth pointing out that leprosy, like in the case of Naaman, has a great symbolical, maybe that's not the right word, but comparison to sin itself. And once sin has been dealt with properly and it has been forgiven, that person is to be accepted back in full fellowship with people of God. Well, leprosy could be in garments or houses. One could build a house and find it there. But the thing that concerned them the most at this point as they moved into the land of Canaan is they were acquiring houses built by somebody else. And they had vineyards that they did not plant and houses they did not build. So what do you do if this house has this leprous situation? Bob makes the point that this perhaps in referring to clothing and houses as some kind of blight caused by the growth of a fungus or mildew or something similar. I have nothing to say that I have a better idea. This makes as much sense as anything else. But it was not sinful if this condition appeared. It was sinful to not clean or deal with it as prescribed to clean it. Case of garments, if spots appeared, the priest examined the color of spots, and I think the colors were red or green. If color was confirmed to be leprosy, then the garment was monitored, watched to see if it faded or spread. If it faded, then wash it and use it. If it spreads, then it is unclean until it is burned. In the case of a house where you think there's leprosy, the priest is called to come and he goes to the house and inspects the spots. If the color and reading this, you could have something on a wall that might be red or green, but it might not be leprous. Someone could spill tomato juice and make a red spot, for instance. And I'm being facetious, but I'm trying to make the point. It had to be determined there was more than something just on the surface that could, you know, be taken away maybe by scraping or washing. But if it was something beyond the surface, and it was red or green, then the situation was observed. And if it was, let me go back. If the color confirms the condition, then the occupants had to move out, and then the house was monitored and watched to see whether it fades or spreads. If spreading, the first round was to attempt to cleanse it by removing and replacing the plaster and the stones in the house. That which was removed, that debris, had to be put in an unclean place that was set aside for these kinds of things. Then they had to watch for its return. If there was no return, then the house was cleansed and they could move back. If the leprosy returns after having gone through what we just talked about, the house had to be torn down, debris removed to an unclean place. This prevented the reuse of those materials in another house. One entering the house or staying overnight in the house was also unclean until made clean. This leads one to think that the priest would become unclean if he entered that house, and that was found to be the case. It would be unclean every time he went back to check. People who would remove and repair and replace or tear down would be unclean until they were cleansed. So there covers a lot of ground here relative to these houses. There was uncleanness from discharges or issues. That could come from diseases or infections, man and wife relations, woman's menstrual cycle, among other things. There was contact with a dead body. If it happened in a tent, suppose you were sitting with a loved one and they die, in the tent of the occurrence of death, one could be rendered unclean. In the field, in other words, working where there are graves or bodies. In battle, anything touched by one while unclean becomes unclean. And this is where it really gets interesting. Anyone touching this unclean also becomes unclean. In all cases, elaborate steps were taken, required to be taken to establish the time to remain unclean and to use the waters of purification. Then there was cleanliness required in the camp, whether regular encampments or towns or on army campaigns. Here we're talking about a leper. They were to isolate and put outside the camp. Those with issues or discharges, those with contact with a dead body. Matter of waste, human waste, and its elimination. There was, for soldiers on campaign, a place appointed for them to go, dig holes, and cover their waste. They were to remember the Lord moves about the camp and must not see anything indecent, and then turn away from the people. I thought over and over as I was studying this and reading about this, it's helpful to keep in mind that the nations round about them most likely didn't do this. Was built everywhere. I can think of medieval towns where there was garbage in the streets, sewer waste, those kinds of things. What was it like? God's people were to be different. And it was to show respect for themselves, but most of all for God. Then, since some things were cleansed by the water of purification, the scriptures tell us how it was to be prepared. There are detailed instructions, and they involve elaborate steps to obtain ashes from the burning of a particular kind of red heifer, and I didn't go into that. But when the need arose, then water was added to these ashes from a spring to make the required solution to be used by the priest to cleanse a house from leprosy or a person defiled by contact with a dead body. The defiled object was sprinkled with water purification in order to cleanse it. In this study, there's also the matter of special times that God's people were to observe. These were appointed to be observed as God commanded. The Lord's appointed feasts were proclaimed to be sacred assemblies. And I recall a lesson that Bob did here about why do we assemble and why do we do what we do. And they have heritage, if you will, in these assemblies God's people practiced back then as to their assemblies and what they did. These times appointed were to be a reminder of God's blessings for their rest, for feasting together, and times for rejoicing. There were, for these special times, there were also particular sacrifices for the congregation in addition to daily offerings and sacrifices already prescribed. And I didn't go through those, but they are elaborate. What is required for each of these special days in addition to the daily things. But there was the Sabbath day, new moons, Passover, Feast of Weeks, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, Feast of Ingathering. And in this case, on all 8 days of the Feast of Ingathering, there was a different quantity each day, and I believe it decreased each day. Well, let's look at those in order. Sabbath day was kept as prescribed day of holy convocation or assembly. They assembled to worship. Priests had special duties. Even though there was no work required, they had to work to do those duties. By New Testament times, we find Jews were meeting in synagogues. New moons were on the first day of each month. You might call this a month, first of the month day. But on this day, silver trumpets, which had been defined by God, were to be blown over the new moon sacrifices. This, too, is an occasion to assemble. The yearly feast, 3 primary ones. They are after the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Harvest or Weeks, Feast of Ingathering or Tabernacles. Note, only men were required to attend these 3 feasts, but women and children were welcomed. However, sometimes women and children were unable to attend, and so it was no sin if they couldn't come under those circumstances. Events in the 7th month are particular of interest. During this month, these things happen. The Feast of Trumpets, which occurred with new moon in the 7th month. Now, what he's saying is here, the 7th month, when you have the new moon, it is a special kind of new moon known as the Feast of Trumpets, because there are more sacrifices required and therefore more blowing of the trumpets. The Day of Atonement, one of the most important days of the year for God's people. It was to be a lasting ordinance as long as Israel existed. Special animals were selected for sacrifice. It was on the 10th day of the 7th month. People were to afflict their souls. And I want you to note this, there was no affliction of the body. God never required that in Old Testament worship. They were to fast and forego amusements. That was the closest it came to making a self-sacrifice. It is the only fast commanded in all the Bible. It was to be treated as a Sabbath day of solemn rest. No work was to be done. And on that day, atonement was made for the high priest, then atonement for the people. We may not finish that, but we will get it in the next class if I don't. Feast of Tabernacles. It was a celebration at the end of the year's agricultural cycle when the harvests were done and they had sown their new crops for the next year. It was a 7-day feast. There were 2 purposes for it. There was to be thanksgiving for the harvest, and there was a time to remember their years in the wilderness when they dwelt in tents. Compare this, then, and its simplicity to pagan and idolatrous harvest festivals where things were just wild. God's people were different. There were holy assemblies on the 1st and the 8th day of this feast, and also special sacrifices made. Then there was the Sabbath year. On this year, no crops were planted. The lands lie fallow. It occurs once every 7 years in the 7th year. They were allowed to use the yield of unplanted and untended land. You might say, how could there be food on untended, unplanted land? Those of you who grew up in farm country know about volunteer crops. Seeds are dropped. Plants come back. So whatever that land yielded from a volunteer crop could be theirs to feed on throughout this year. There were serious warnings in the law to observe the Sabbath year, else the land would be laid waste and their cities destroyed. This is given as a key reason for the Jewish Babylonian captivity. During this year, there was the freeing of Hebrew slaves and the releasing of debts among Hebrews. At Feast of Tabernacles in the Sabbath year, the law was to be read aloud to the whole assembly. The year of Jubilee. After every 7th Sabbath year, they were to consecrate the 50th year as the year of Jubilee. As in a Sabbath year, the land lies fallow. This would mean 2 consecutive years since the 49th year was a Sabbath year. They were to release servants from debts, property of people returned, and they could in fact return to their homes if they had previously sold them. There was laws for Israel's treatment and regard for its poor. This is seen, first of all, in the treatment of slaves and debtors in the year of Jubilee. But there were other rules given. They were to have justness as far as loan availability and not make a distinction between people, and also interest required among people. There was to be fair treatment required if one sells self as a servant to another Hebrew. Hebrew treatment of servants, male and female, obtained from nations about. They were required to be fair. There were fairness rules to be observed if a Hebrew who has had to sell themselves as a servant and now wants to redeem themselves. The person who owned him couldn't say, no, you signed a contract. I expect you to hold to it. This person comes in and says, I got the money. These are the terms. I'm going to redeem myself. He was required to let that person redeem himself. He could not be unfair and mistreat him. Remember, all belongs to God, people and lands. Therefore, he sets the rules. And the Hebrews were to regard their fellow human beings as special. Then there's vows or solemn promises. Second bell ring. Don't know that we can cover this, but this was an act of voluntary sacrifice by one who made the vow. It involved property and actions. It was freely offered to invoke the Lord's favor or to express profound gratitude or blessings. The law defined kinds of acceptable vows and how they were to be satisfied or fulfilled. It provided means to redeem and buy back what one had vowed if one that was permitted. It also said which vows were binding. There were some that were not. For example, a wife or a daughter's vows were not binding unless the husband or father agreed to it. His silence was considered agreement. The vow of the widow before she was widowed was considered binding. Some things could not be vowed as sacrifice. That is, if they had already been commanded by God. You couldn't say, I'm giving that as a vow if God's already required it. Then there's a special vow, the Nazarite vow, described in Numbers 6, 1 through 21. I think I want to stop here, and Lord willing, we'll pick this up and try to get this and the next lesson in the next class. Appreciate your attention.